the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. The Navy SEALs are one of the elite fighting forces in the U.S. Armed Services. Michael Thornton is one of the elite of that force. He is the recipient of the nation's highest award for valor, the Medal of Honor. In October 1972, he was one of a five-member team inserted into Vietnam to gather intelligence on North Vietnamese troop movements. The team was discovered by the enemy and engaged in a five-and-a-half-hour firefight against a vastly superior force. During that battle, Thornton saved the life of his superior officer, who was seriously wounded. His road to the SEALs and to Vietnam and the Medal of Honor began in Spartansburg, South Carolina.
I grew up in the hills of South Carolina. Major influences on my life was my mother and my father. My dad only had a sixth grade education, but he very loyal man to this great country of ours. He spent from 1937 to 1946 in the Army and was over in the Philippines, and he never spoke about it to actually my second tour when I came back from Vietnam. He actually sat down and we discussed a little bit. But hardworking man, his family was everything to him, his country. All through the Army, put all three of his sisters to high school and college. He sent all his money back, made sure that they had a great education. My father and mother, my father gave me all the material things that you basically could understand. My mother supported the love, you know. My dad never told me he loved me until later on in his lifetime, which I almost fainted when I heard the words, but they came, and that's the most important thing.
Brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother and a younger baby sister. I never got to really watch her grow up because she was like 7 years younger than I was as I grew up. So I was already in Vietnam when she was like in the sixth grade, and I'd come home just to visit her. I always thought she was a little princess, but she turned out to be one of the greatest women I've ever known in my life, and a great family person. And my brother is just a great young man. Because he couldn't go in the military, he had been injured playing football. Stopped growth, nerve damage, and his growth in his right leg quit growing, and so they couldn't. You know, he was unable, but it really bothered him bad that, you know, that he couldn't support our country because of how we were brought up by our parents.
Mm-hmm. What about education? High school in South Carolina?
I went to high school in Spartanburg High School. Played sports and stuff, but I was kind of not a radical, but I was always in a mischief, I guess, you know. And back then, I knew I was studying hard, but I wasn't seeing it going where, of course, now we call it dyslexia or learning disabilities and all. But back then, I knew I was studying, but I wasn't really getting to where I really wanted to be in life. But, you know, I had great friends there, and high school was great for me. If it came to go fishing or hunting, I'd much rather go do that than go to school. So I was known quite often to drive in the parking lot, pick up my shotgun and stuff, and take off and go duck hunting or something. And my mom would get a phone call and said, "Well, Mike's done it again," you know. So then you get suspended. But school was good for me. My dad found out he had an insulation company, and he found out, instead of me sitting home when I got suspended, he put me under every house that he could find with water and mud, and had me put up insulation bats or put me in the attic blowing rock wool, and I'd look like Smokey the Bear when you come out of that area. So he found out, he wanted to try to explain to me, you can live like this for the rest of your life, or you can go to school and try to get an education. So.
Well, that couldn't have been much fun in a 100-degree Spartanburg summer.
Well, 140 degrees in those attics, I promise you that.
Is that what prompted you to look into the Navy?
Well, I figured I always knew I wanted to join the Navy. I saw the movie The Five Sullivan Brothers, and we had a very strong family. My dad brought a lot of my mother's family down from West Virginia, and and help get them started and stuff like that. And my so I saw the movie The Five Sullivan Brothers, so it was a very strong family net in what they believed in. It was a lot of things I saw my family bringing me up. And then I was a very good swimmer. My father couldn't swim a lick, and my brother and I started both going to swim classes when we were very young. And we were both on swim teams and did very well. And I saw that crazy movie, The Frogman, with Richard Whitmark. And I said, well, I'm going to join the Navy, and I'm going to be a Navy frogman. So when my time to come, I joined the military. Actually, I went on a 120-day program back in I was kind of in some of my mischief ways. I was talking to this young judge, and I said, Mike, what'd I tell you if you ever get up here again? And I said, well, Your Honor, said I may have to go to reform school. He said, I'm going to let you make your first major decision in life. Make an about face and look at those fine men in uniform. And I turn around, and there's a second-class machinist mate recruiter there. I saluted him. I said, I've always wanted to be a Navy frogman, sir. So that was how I got into the Navy, and the rest is history as I plodded on through.
What do you have to do after you get in to qualify to get into the SEAL program?
Well, back in when I went through, it was called Underwater Demolition Recruit Training. It was still part of the old UDT training. Of course, you had to go. This is one thing my dad always taught, you never give up, you never quit. And that's something that was always in our family. And I knew that before I ever joined the military. And when I went through training, it was down on Naval Amphibious Base in Coronado, California, and they didn't even have the bridge there or nothing. And so basically, you used to every morning you get up, you look across at 32nd Street, and I knew I didn't really want to ride a ship. So it was, even though you failed your inspection, you know how spotless or how great your shoes looked or how great your bulk looked or how much you had ironed your things, you know you were going in the water every morning. But I looked across that way, and I said, well, that's the last place I'm going to be is aboard a Navy ship. But training, we started off with 129 guys in my class, and we graduated with 16, and part of that 16 was rolled back a little bit because they had problems with their swimming, diving, which was the last part. And when I came in the SEAL team, we had about 236 SEALs combined, and we only had like 206s in all the SEAL team because there wasn't really a community. Our CEOs were 03s and 04s back then, basically. So then we had the SEAL Team 1 and 2 were the only SEAL Team 1 in Coronado and SEAL Team 2 in Virginia Beach. Then we had UDTs 11, 12, and 13 in Coronado, then 21 and 22 over there. And then you watch this community build what it is today. It says they've done remarkable great things.
That's an enormous attrition rate.
Oh, yeah.
Have that few left, and not have you're having that many start.
Well, most of them, in the first 8 weeks, basically, and you lost a lot of them. They thought they knew what they wanted to be. Then they start training, and you go through pre-training, and they said, "This is not for me," you know. And I've always said, going through SEAL training is first of all it's mental, then it's physical, then it's as I call operational. In other words, you have to have the mental capacity to understand what you're doing, especially when you actually get put into the job. I mean, it's just like as Tom Hunter was just speaking before. You know, can you imagine where they were flying at if you didn't have the mental capacity to understand the dangers of the job? But you got to be able to overcome these things, and that's what I taught all my young men and has ever worked for me, and even everyday life today. You know, even that's in everybody's everyday life, because if you don't have the mental capacity to handle that position that you're in, you should not be there. No matter what great physical shape you're in or how smart you are, if you can't make those decisions that you need to be making, you should never be in that position.
So when you finished your training, where did you deploy first?
I went to SEAL Team 1. One thing about SEAL Team, they made sure that you're well-trained before. My first deployment was to Vietnam, and I had four tours over the Far East Asia with Vietnam and also in Thailand, and came back on my fourth tour January 13th, 1973. And that was my dad's birthday. That's the reason I remember that so well.
So what exactly were you doing in Vietnam?
Well, when you were in a platoon, you were working basically, we had 12 enlisted and 2 officers, and you worked together as a platoon in a 7-man group. And then when I went back over as an advisor, you would be working with the PRUs, approves the PRUs, or you'd be working with the Kit Carson Scouts, which are actually XVC that you hoyed over, and they wanted to work with the Americans because of one thing about the Vietnamese families, I found out they're very loyal to their families, and when you hurt someone in their family or a daughter or son or something like that, they'd always want to get back, you know, and fight for the real reasons. And a lot of them saw that maybe communist wasn't the right way, you know, when they'd wipe out a whole village, and they said, well, maybe this is not what I want to be after all. And then we had what we call the LDNs, the Luy Nhan Dai, which was the Vietnamese SEALs that we were trained in Cam Ranh Bay. And these guys are great guys, and which I operated with them on two tours over to Vietnam.
But what were you training him to do?
Well, SEAL Team, you know, supposedly UDT is to the high water line. SEAL Team was from the high water line inland to 5 miles. Well, you know, when you're at Thuy Nhan, there's no, or you and, I think they, what the Admiral Zumwalt saw, the high water line was the rivers anywhere. So of course we started putting us, because we were basically, most of us were working in Four Corps, which were all the swamps and stuff like that, and we were all, like I say, very good in the water. So he saw, that's how we, in 1966, 67 is when we SEAL Team started making a niche for himself, because in Na Bay, where all the ships were getting actually ambushed and stuff before they could get up to Saigon or places where they could offload their supplies and stuff. We started putting SEALs in action there, then down at the mouth of the Bosok at Dung Island to Mito, and also the mouth of the Bosok down to Binh Tuy, and then you had entrance to Sok Trang and stuff like that to resupply zone. So we started working on all the rivers, and of course the rivers run as far north as you can possibly run.
Our guest is former Navy SEAL Michael Thornton, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for Valor in the Vietnam War. The conversation will continue after these messages.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with Michael Thornton, a former Navy SEAL and a recipient of the Medal of Honor for his actions during the war in Vietnam. In September 1972, only three Navy SEALs were left in Vietnam, and Thornton was one of them.
September the 6th of 1972, they pulled all the American troops out with the exception of Army Special Forces, Navy SEALs, and Marine Recons. And basically, that's why we were basically working on operations like that at that period of time. Before then, and we were working alongside the LDNs, the Vietnamese Navy SEALs, because at that time there were supposed to be Vietnamese operations with the SEALs in as an advisor capacity, basically. But we found ourselves still leading the operations because the Vietnamese didn't really want to lead the operations. They would be there with us. Two of the Vietnamese on the operation when I received my medal were actually, I'd worked with on two previous tours. We'd been in a lot of combat operations together. These guys were people you could really count on at all times, no matter how tough the going got or how bad the situation looked. They were always there alongside you.
Tell us about the event which led to your being honored in the way that you were. What happened?
The mines to be, of course, this was in October. They kind of came up with an idea. The NVA had already started moving south. They'd already moved across the out of Qua Viet. And so what they wanted to do, they wanted us to go up and do a recon of the area and see what type of forces they had in there. And it kind of sounds strange. They wanted to do an amphibious landing and cut the supply lines and the logistics and stuff, and try to sign a treaty. Of course, the treaty was going on back in Paris at the time, And I kind of looked at Tom Norris, which was the officer in charge of the operation, kind of giggled. I said, you know, we've been trying to shut down their logistic lines, but they would never let us bomb Ho Chi Minh Trail and all these other things, which, of course, a lot of us knew there. But it was kind of like what's going on in Iraq right now. It was a political war instead of a war that should have been taken care of by warriors making the decisions in our country, supporting our decisions. And so I said, well, whatever you say, sir. I mean, Tom's a very close friend of mine, of course. And he said, he told Captain Shively at the time, he said, I'll do the operation if I can pick my team. And I know Captain Shively said, who do you want? He said, I want Mike Thornton. And he said, well, good choice. And even though I wasn't the senior enlisted guy there, they considered me the senior enlisted because I had more tours than anybody else. So at that time, I was only an E5, and I had several E6s and a lot of E5s and a lot of young men. Now, most of the SEALs we had were on their third tour or their second tour at least, and we had about five young SEALs. The reason I went over is trying to make sure we got them back alive. And mm-hmm. with the grace of the good Lord, we got everybody back after that.
So he puts the team together. You're off on your recon mission. Well, and what happened?
Well, we off our recon mission, and put a little bit before the story, the Newport News, I don't know if y'all remember, September the 6th, the center gun turret blew up and killed 11 sailors, and they'd pulled it off the line and taken over to the Philippines. And that was the Admiral's flagship, basically. And the Admiral moved his flag out in the fleet, not Admiral Wilson, which had the Vietnam, which was an aviator. But the surface admiral in charge had moved his flag from that to the USS Mahan, which was a destroyer. And what we were going to do, they were going to vector us in off the coast, and we were going to get into an IBS, get to about a mile or so off the beach, slip in the water, swim to the shoreline, go in and do our recon, then extract before morning and come out with the intelligence. Well, we went up on two Vietnamese junks, which were both about 44 feet long, and we were patrolled up there. Well, one of the destroyers got pulled off for some reason. And so when they went to vector, they couldn't really do a vector. A vector is where one destroyer would shoot a azimuth, the other would shoot, and the cross points would be where they would see where we are. They give us a compass heading, we'd go in there. So basically, but the officer in charge of the Vietnamese junks, which patrolled that for sandpans and stuff all the time, along with the U.S. Navy's fleet and for support, he said, that's the Quaviette right there. And then I said, are you sure? He said, yeah, we're sure. And so basically what we did, we went ahead and went on with the operation. But we got in to the shoreline, and I was carrying a starlight stub. And I said, Tom, I don't see the Quaviette, the river. And Tommy says, well, run up there. And so I run up. We got everybody set up an OP. And I went north for about 10 minutes and took the starlight. Couldn't see no river. Came back, said no river. And went south for about 10 minutes, looked around, said I couldn't see no river. I said, I don't see a river in sight. So I'm sure as large as the Quaviette in the mouth coming in, we should be able to see it. Well, Tom said, well, we'll go ahead and patrol in, pick up as much intelligence, come back out, call for an extraction in mouth. Well, we thought we were in the area of the Quaviette, but really and truly, we weren't supposed to be in North Vietnam back then, but we're actually, when the final thing, we're actually 9 clicks into North Vietnam is where the operation took place. And as we were walking, patrolling that evening, we saw bunkers and tanks and 188 gun emplacements, Russian gun emplacements. We saw bonfires, which it wasn't like they were really trying to hide their positions. Just, you know, regimental NV guys in NVA uniforms and stuff like that, and they're looking at the push.
Michael Thornton's courage under fire was about to be tested to the extreme. He relates that story when we return to Veterans Chronicles after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012. 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out, get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest pace.
That's the ammunition and
we'll for Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest is former Navy SEAL Michael Thornton, a recipient of the Medal of Honor for Valor during the war in Vietnam. On September 31st, 1972, he saved the life of his superior officer who had been severely wounded during a reconnaissance mission. That happened during the course of a 5.5-hour-long firefight with an enemy force that vastly outnumbered the 5-man SEAL team. The officer whose life he saved, Navy Lieutenant Thomas Norris, is also a Medal of Honor recipient for an earlier action in Vietnam. Thornton relates the events of that September day for Veterans Chronicles.
During the firefight, we had eliminated, I'd shot at least 33 at that period of time. And I don't know what Tommy had gotten and basically what the whole story was. But every time these guys, I would shoot. Then I'd roll over and come up to another position. Then I'd shoot and I'd roll over and come to another position. Then when they were trying to flank, they slowly took our position as we kept slowly moving back, which at the time I didn't know. Tommy and them had interrogated the guy that I had knocked out, and he was showing us where we were and was able to call in gunfire support. Actually, U.S. Mahan came in to try to give us support with the 5-inch guns. They couldn't get close enough to the beach. They were getting blown off the beach by the Russian artillery they had there. And they really and truly, they had an idea where we were, but weren't certain where we were. And as the firefight went on and on, they got so close to us as from here to say that door, which is 10 feet away. So this is a large sand dune. I'm on one side of the sand dune. There's four enemy on the other side of the sand dune, and they're throwing a grenade over at me. This is one of the old Chi-Com grenades, and I grab the grenade, and I throw the grenade back over there, and I'm going 2,000, 3,000. Of course, we know we have a four-second instantaneous grenade in America. It's going 7,000, 8,000. Grenade comes back over, and I said, I'm going 9,000, 10,000. I throw the grenade back over there, you know. I'm going 18,000. This damn grenade comes over for the fifth time. I said, oh, my God, it's got to go. And I rolled over, and the grenade went off, and I was hit with 6 shrapnel wounds in my back, and I yelled, and you could hear Tommy at the top, Mike, are you okay? You're okay. I said nothing because I wanted them to think that I was out, and I looked up, and four of them came over there, and I shot all four of them. Two fell on top of me, two fell backwards, and we couldn't understand what was going on, and they fell back, and Tommy said, what are they falling back for? I said, God, I don't know. I mean, they're still, because I'll never forget when the firefight started, Tommy said, we can handle 50 of them. And I said, well, you know, I'll never forget that, you know, but he always had a positive attitude about everything, and and it's the thing, I mean, we were laughing. I know he says, well, what are you laughing about? I said, well, crying's not going to do us any good, you know. So you always have to take that moment of fear and stuff, and you have to focus it and put it in the right position and use it in, as a benefit, not as a, because fear is a great thing, and you can focus it, and you can, as long as you can control it. And that goes back to that mental thing I said. So I climbed up where Tommy was, and we're looking around. I looked across the lagoon, and we were being surrounded by a regiment, and they knew that Americans were there, and they were coming to the south of the lagoon. We could see them going to the north of the lagoon. At this time, it's when Tom says, you, Ty, and Quan, and fall back to that sand dune. It was about 500 yards away, and I'll cover your retreat. Then myself and Dang will fall back, and then we'll jump in the water and swim for it. Just to get out in the water. And he said, oh, the Newport News, we've heard the Newport News is coming in. They had just came back. That was October 31st, 1972. They had just come back on the line that day from Subic, where they'd been in the shipyards, and it had those 8-inch guns, which were good for about 18 miles, and they knew that we could give them. And so when I fell back with Quan and Ty, then I waited for Tom. We were yelling, "Tom, fall back, fall back." And this was like 12:30 in the morning, well, in the early afternoon. So the firefight had been going on from like 5:30 that morning, back and forth. And I don't think they really knew how the extent of personnel we had in there, because, like I said, I constantly stayed on the move for two reasons. They couldn't pinpoint my position. Another reason is that they really gave them a false pretense of how many people, and they could see that they were hitting, shot up their Tommy, and Tommy would move down on the lower side of the dune and back up. So we kept moving us around where they couldn't really pinpoint us very well. And that we made it that far, it was unbelievable. So when I fell back to the dune, Tommy was moving back, and Dane comes back by himself, the radio with the radio. Well, he had been shot through the radio twice and had two pieces of metal embedded in his back, hit the radio and ricocheted off. And the radio was no good. And I said, "Where's Tommy? Where's Tommy?" He said, "Mike Dow, he's dead." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "He was shot in the head." I said, "You stay here. I'll go get Tommy." And I said, no, he's dead, Mike." And he grabbed me, and I said, "Stay here." And when I went back, they saw me going back after Tom. And they started, moving towards up to the dune. And I knew the last place he was. And he was lying on the side of the dune. And eliminated quite a few people running up there. I eliminated them. I grabbed Tommy. And I could hear this round coming in. And luckily, Tommy, I don't know who I know he called in the gunfire support. He had one smoke, and he said "fire for effect" was the last word later on that I found, years later on, when he could actually explain the whole story. And I was running down the north end of that dune, and that round hit on the south end of that dune, and the concussion blew me like 20 feet, and I could see Tommy leaving my shoulders and flying off. And I went over and grabbed him. He said, "Mike, buddy." Well, you have to understand the damage this guy had shot through the left temple. The bullet exited his forehead, his whole, his left eye was gone, his cheekbone area was gone, his forehead was completely gone from almost his nose back towards his temple. And the bullet, when it went through, it kind of, I guess it angled up and just blew. I took that period of time, I didn't have enough time, but I picked him. I knew he was still alive. I threw him on my shoulders, and I started running with him back to the sand dune. I got back to the sand dune, and there's my two boys, Ty and Quan, giving me, laying down a base of fire to keep the guys off us. And you're running, you're not really thinking, but all you can see is sand flying everywhere, and you're saying, what, are they bad shots, or I'm just a lucky son of a gun? So we got back there, and I said, "Where's Ty? Where's Ty?" And they said, "Mikey left." And I guess the young officer, when I went back to get Tommy, he had told the guys, "Let's go swim for it. They're both will be dead." And they didn't. They stayed and waited for me. And they said, "What do you do now?" I said, "We swim." I was basically out of ammunition. Tommy had an AK-47, which I picked his AK-47 up as laying next to him, because I knew I was very low on ammunition. And I knew that he still had quite a bit of ammunition left, because he spent so much time on the radio. And I said, "What else?" When I yell "one," we'll leapfrog down. When I yell "one," I said, "Dang, you lay down a base of fire." When I yell "two," I said, "Quan, you lay down a vessel of fire." When I yell "three," I'll lay down, then we'll just leapfrog all the way down to the beach. So we got near the ocean side, and I got shot through my left calf and fell to the ground, and got back up and took Tommy and put him under my arm. And I was dragging him out through the water, the surf zone. And as the surf was coming in, I was walking backwards, still firing, and I could see Quan and Dane in front of me. I never did see Ty. And they were got through the surf zone, so I was taking Tommy and me and pushing us underneath the surf, because I kept keep our silhouettes very low instead of getting on top of the surf and be a bigger target. Another reason it wouldn't wash us in as easy either. And we got through the surf zone. I threw my weapon away because I was out of ammunition, and I kept Tommy's AK, and I started swimming with Tommy. And I had Tommy up front with me, and as I swam, I looked over the side, and I see this thing floundering in the water past the surf zone. It was young, my boy Quan, and he had got shot through his right hip, His whole buttocks was gone. He couldn't swim. He was trying to pull. So I took a life jacket after we got out past the surf area, and I put it over Tommy's head, but I didn't inflate it. It's the old UDT life jacket. It was almost like an H harness, and I put it on my back, and I took Juan, put my arms underneath him, and had him put his arms over my shoulder and held Tommy, and we started swimming seaward for several hours until we were picked up. The bad thing about it, the Newport News turned around and left our position, and they thought we were all dead. Had a Ford Observer plane that was up there, and they had actually taken pictures. They told him to leave the area before he got blown out of the sky, but he had taken several pictures, and they could see what was laying on the beach and stuff like that, and they thought that we were dead, and that's the reason Newport News. But we had on all our insertion and extraction craft, we always have another Navy SEAL, and there's a young petty officer named Woody Woodruff. He said, where was the last time they're seen? He would never give up, and he kept searching back and forth. And actually, he picked Ty up almost an hour before, and he said that Tommy was dead, because that's the last word he heard, that Tommy was dead. He said, I was missing, and he said he thought the other two LDNs were still swimming in. So he sent the other junk up to look for Quan and Dane. And when I saw the junk, I took the AK and shot it in the sky. And I know when we got out way past the area, we got out of their line of fire, we got about a mile off the coast. I said, we'll go swim south, guys, swim south. And
how long were you in the water?
Anywhere from 2 to 3 hours. It was hard to really determine at the time. Mm-hmm. They say in that citation, they say 2 hours or more, so it really doesn't matter. But the most important thing about the operation, we got everybody out alive. And
so then you came home at some point, and where did you go from there in your career?
Well, I think I need to tell this part of the story about Tom.
Yes.
Because after we got picked up by the junks, we called the Newport News back, and I had already taken 2 4x4 dressings to try to cover Tommy's wounds, and I thought it would be no way in hell that he would ever make it. So the Newport News came in. I picked Tommy up, took him down, laid him on the gurney, and offered. They had a doctor, had a lieutenant commander, surgeon down there, and he says, he hasn't got a chance, Mike. And, of course, as I said, in September the 6th of 1970, they pulled all the American troops out, and that was also basic neurosurgeons and all this other stuff had been pulled out, too. So we got Tommy medevaced back to Da Nang. I stayed on board the ship because my Vietnamese guys didn't speak very good English, and they were... three of us were wounded besides Ty, and so make sure they got well taken care of and get them off the next day. So I called Captain Shively, and a young man by the name of Ryan McCombie was there waiting on Tommy, and they had Tommy there, and they sent in a 141 from Clark's Air Force Base with two medical teams. And it was a great time because this was October 31st, and they had already started moving doctors there because they knew that we were working for the to free our prisoner of wars, and that's when they were to Clark's first. So they had neurosurgeons there and everything. So when people like Jim Stockdale and Bud Day and Leo Thornis and other great Americans got off the plane, they would be there to take right. care of their energies. So it was really so because some of the best neurosurgeons in the military were sitting there waiting on them. So when they got Tommy there, he went through his first operation. It was 19 and a half hours long. And the report guy said he still won't make it. And he stayed in the Philippines for almost, that was until March, until they figured he was stable enough to move back to Bethesda. And that was in April, I found out that I had been submitted for the Medal of Honor, and I received it in October. And he was still at Bethesda in October. And he spent almost 6.5 years going through operations before he was basically later on released. And so I tell these kids, don't ever give up when you see these kids in the hospital. Here's a guy that spent 6.5 years and later on became an FBI agent through Judge Webster, gave me a waiver. And he was a great undercover FBI agent for 22 years. So I have two great friends of mine. Bob Carey on one side became a governor, United States Senator, which lost a limb, his leg. Then I got Tommy. So I said, you know, you can do anything you want to as long as you got it in the mind and the heart to what you want to do in your lifetime. So you never give up in anything.
Was your father still living when you were nominated?
Oh, yes, sir. My dad's still
was he
80.
Still living when you received it?
Yes, sir. It's the first time he's been in Washington, D.C., first time he flew an airplane. Got the notice from the president, said, here's your airplane ticket. He thought it was, he thought that President Nixon was giving the order to fly. He's never flown again since. So
But what a thing for him after having kept you in a attic blowing insulation in the Spartanburg summer to see his son in the office for the president.
He's still my
greatest. Around your neck.
Yeah, he's still my greatest hero.
We've been talking this week with Medal of Honor recipient Michael Thornton, former Navy SEAL who served with great distinction during the war in Vietnam. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.